From the Sky News Centre, the daughter of a British couple who died at a hotel in Egypt is blaming something suspicious. Amelia Cox has more.
Thomas Cook says there's no evidence John and Susan Cooper died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Their daughter's in shock.
I watched them both die before my very eyes and they had exactly the same symptoms.
Kelly Ormerod insists they were healthy just hours earlier.
If we didn't have come on this holiday, my parents would still be alive.
Thomas Cook is moving 300 customers to other hotels in Hurghada, including Matt Higgins and his family.
We have been worried since last night when they called us in. They're not going to call you in because you're having a heart attack.
Hotel bosses believe the couple died of natural causes. Authorities there say they both had heart failure.
Alex Salmond has strenuously denied two sexual harassment complaints made against him during his time as Scottish First Minister. Police Scotland says it's received information which it's assessing. Tottenham and France captain Hugo Lloris has apologised after being charged with drink driving after being arrested in London early this morning. The Frenchman led his national team to World Cup victory last month. A 22-year-old woman has been charged with conspiracy to commit grievous bodily harm following a suspected acid attack on a toddler in Worcester. Six other men, including the three-year-old's father, have also been charged after the incident in July. Gale force winds and heavy rain are threatening the bank holiday weekend. The Met Office says Sunday's looking like the worst day for travelling. And Jose Mourinho has denied talk of a rift with Manchester United's executive vice chairman Ed Woodward. It comes after their first defeat of the season on Sunday, going down 3-2 at Brighton.
Difficulties after the match you lose is always difficult, especially for people that really cares about the job, about being a football professional. But after that, you think about the next match. You do the same when you win.
And Lewis Hamilton was second fastest in the second practice ahead of this weekend's Belgian F1 Grand Prix. That's the latest. I'm Tanya Snuggs.
Murdoch News at 6. Let us down. This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Ashley, Jude English. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, so you think you couldn't be hoodwinked by the whole media working together to ignore vital facts we all need to know? Think again. The economic war is not just between Trump and Erdogan and Trump and President Xi. What about the war raging between Brussels and Rome that the London media hardly mention? So who chooses Italian governments? Italian voters or Goldman Sachs and Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank? We hear from German blogger Manfred Petrisch. Also, the death of Israeli terrorist who fought the British Mandate in the 1940s. He turned a peace activist and died believing that the 1990s Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned by his own state. Yuri Avany, who was he? The Jewish terrorist who sided with the Palestinians. The FBI and others moved to impeach US President Donald Trump, a little bit inching further forward. He explains to Fox News why he thinks his former lawyer, Michael Cohen's been making scurrilous accusations about him. And in our series of getting to know the Israeli cabinet this week, the foreign minister. Who is he or she? What have they been saying this week? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 7 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, a little bit drizzly and cloudy. This weekend, though, cool around 15, 16 Celsius. Sunny periods tomorrow. Dark and raining on Sunday. and actually Monday should be clear. Next week, mostly sunny, but cloud and rain midweek. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of September, warm but quite cloudy, with a sunny week following into September. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Ashley, Jude English. Hi, Jude. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hiya. Nice to be here.
Can you just tell us a bit about yourself and what got you interested in politics, Jude?
Oh, OK. So I've been a kind of environmentalist activist for years. And a few years ago when Caroline became the leader of the Green Party, I suddenly had a bit of an
Caroline Lucas.
I thought, you know, time to step up, do something more actively political, join the Green Party. And 2 years ago I was elected councillor for Ashley. I'd been quite active, you know, doing a lot of stuff in my community, trustee of the farm and all sorts of stuff like that. So decided it was time to step up.
How have you found it? Was it how you expected? You've had a few years doing it now.
Well, so it's, yeah, we're just over the 2 years, just over the halfway point. I think it's been very interesting. It's been quite frustrating. I did know a little bit about what it was going to be like because I had spent some time with councillors beforehand. It's very interesting and you learn a lot. My main problem with local government at the moment is how slow it is and how difficult it is to get anything
Hang
done
on
in Bristol.
A minute. Look, then we were told the mayor was going to speed everything up. That the reason it was so slow is because everyone is always having a go at each other. There's so much party politics. No one can ever make any decisions because everyone's trying to stop whoever's in charge being a success.
Well, it's interesting you should say that because today I was reading a paper where they said exactly that. That was what we were promised. It hasn't been the reality on the ground from where I've been sitting. Slow, 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 nothing getting done. And very frustrating from an opposition viewpoint because we want to do the best for Bristol, yeah. It's not been quite what we were promised, no.
What are the issues at the moment for you anyway? What's engaging you, your time? Never mind what's in the newspapers, but for you on the ground?
On the ground in Ashley, there's a big problem with graffiti. It's really, really ballooned out of Stokes Croft. It's all over Montpellier and kind of where I live near St. Werburgh's. Much, much worse than it used to be. And the police have got no ability to do anything. And it's one of the things I get most complaints about at the moment. So, you know, making the city look presentable was one of Marvin's promises, actually, wasn't it? But so that's a really big issue. And then just local organisations not having enough money to get stuff done. And, of course, the homelessness stuff. We've actually got people in St Andrew's Park under the railway bridge near where I live. It's becoming really quite desperate, isn't it?
Under the railway bridge, that's the sort of place that hidden homeless go to, because we had actually quite a few on College Green, didn't we, that were then evicted by the City Council a month or so ago.
That's right.
The idea is to keep these people out of the way, so long as they're out of sight, out of mind.
I don't know quite what the idea is at the moment, and it's been, if we weren't spending so much time looking at, you know, what we should or shouldn't build somewhere, we might be able to address some of these problems about homelessness, about people with domestic violence backgrounds not getting housed, some of the stuff that I really hoped a kind of socialist mayor would really get his teeth into. So, yes.
Martin, what's your view on Marvin? Is he a socialist mayor?
Well, I mean, he would say that he was. I think the problem is that the powers of local government to do anything constructive are very limited.
Power of the mayor is enormous.
Well, in theory it is, but in practice they've got to lose massive amounts of budget between now and 2020. So all he's really doing is managing the decline of local government in Bristol as a figure. And, you know, the Tories have created these mayors all around the country and have captured, you know, certain, you know, it's almost like a cul-de-sac trap for Labour politicians like Andy Burnham in Manchester and so on. And, of course, they've got no real power. They've actually just got to cut because the central government's already decided what the policy is.
Hang on, Marvin is spending £350 million of our money. That's a certain amount of power, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I mean, the point is that money is there already being spent on certain things, and all he's got to do is decide what he's going to cut, because that's what he's got to do. And, of course, he's not being straight with his own base and saying, you know, all this stuff, things are going to be better and we're going to improve things. That's just not on the cards. The local government is basically being destroyed in this country. In a very short period of time, there will be nothing for local councils to do other than their statutory duties. And in any case, even in the past, only a very small amount of what you spend your money on is discretionary. Most of it's already decided anyway. And that was when there was a stable budget. And there isn't a stable budget. Everything is decided in this country by the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the centre. And that's how, what it's become.
That is true, and this is a difficult position to be in for any leader, to have to manage the decline of a city. So one of the issues is that it would be great to see some leadership and to feel that we were being communicated with about quite how these little pockets of money that are left will be managed. And then, for example, that our cabinet members are keeping a proper eye on stuff, so we're not getting taken to judicial reviews over education budgets and then going to get hammered by court fees.
Just take us through that, because that was quite an interesting incident a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, we had all these big cuts, as described, and you've got to decide where you cut and where you don't cut. It was fairly obvious that you don't cut the statutory budget for education for pupils with special needs, and Cabinet was warned. So it's disappointing when these sorts of decisions kind of go through the system and then we end up going to court.
It does make me wonder, actually, looking at the way that politics works in this city post the mayor coming in, the idea of a mayor, that the mayor is really sitting with what you could call city fathers, with council officers, with the great and good of the region, making decisions that most of what the council is then doing, the actual councillors we elect, is wrangling with the mayor about the decisions he's made, but they can't actually change that decision. Is that fair, Jude?
I'm not sure it's wrangling with the mayor about decisions he's made, because at the moment the decisions are slow in coming. So the major decision is this one over the arena development. The other decisions are delegated to cabinet members to a certain extent. So we've had decisions about libraries that have then been pulled back. We've had decisions about parks that have been pulled back. You know, we've had this, a decision is made and then step back, look at what damage that'll do, and then move back in to try and correct using our reserves, which is something that we can still do because we're a fairly rich city. You know, we're sitting on a certain amount of reserves, which means we're not quite at the level that was described earlier. Although, who's to say that when we look under the carpet next year, you know, find out that things are really, really bad. So I don't really know. It's hard to know what Marvin is doing some of the time, because he doesn't communicate very well down to certainly the likes of me.
Well, he has been communicating this week all about something called a conference centre. Plans for a conference centre, hotel and housing on Arena Island have been revealed.
He hasn't been communicating. If you notice that, Legal and General, who own quite a lot of land in that area already, have provided a press release that fits quite nicely into what he's been saying about let's have a conference centre and let's have some housing. It's very timely. I think it's directly related to the fact we've just called for an extraordinary full council meeting and now he's had to kind of get some more cards out and lay them on the table. You could argue, what's Legal and General been doing all this time? There's loads of land around Bristol where we could have a conference centre. Do we need to sell that land to them and just let them get on with it? Is that just how we do it? I mean, they say they're going to put affordable housing in there, but their record on that's quite poor. The last planning application they put in for a big build, they had four affordable houses out of a huge kind of 250 flat site. So we've got to keep an eye on these sorts of developers. Well, That's why controlling the land and doing our own builds, whatever it is still a good thing.
Well, why does it matter what is on that site? It doesn't, does it? Surely anything could be there. A conference centre is just as good as having an arena.
I suppose it depends how you think that the democratic process should move forward. I mean, we have a local plan. It says that we're going to build an arena and some other things on that site. One of the issues for the extraordinary council meeting will be to say, are we bound by policy? If we've said we were going to have an arena there, you know, do we still have to do that? Or is it within the power of the mayor to say, I've decided to change everything?
But Martin, surely at the end of the day, it's just really about who's got the money to build it, and they will build it wherever they want.
Well, as you know, Tony, the developers have a very strong hand in the legal system in Britain. If for example, I was involved peripherally in earlier discussions about what was going to happen down there when I was a council officer. And the fact is that if the developers can sit there and they can come up with their proposals, and if the council blocks their proposals, they can appeal. But if the central government will then find in favour of the developers, so the whole thing is rigged in favour of the developers.
I mean, isn't this just the way things are going? Ordinary councils are doing far less. Central government is doing far less. All it's doing is basically cutting its cloth to fit its coat, if you want, like the size, and it can't afford to do this sort of thing. So if a big developer comes along like YTL and says, look, we're happy to do an arena, but it's going to have to be at Filton, surely we haven't got a lot of option.
Well, that's right. And of course, the other thing, of course, is that councils want to keep frontline services going. Obviously, that's the thing that punters want to see. They want to see the frontline services kept going. So the temptation to do deals with developers, and look about the selling off of the port, all the land around the port at Avonmouth when George was the king. And of course, that meant there was an immediate boost to the council's coffers, so they could spend on frontline services. But in the long run, that was really stupid. That land was very, very valuable. If the Chinese do come in and build a deep water port there, that land is going to be fantastically profitable, and it's been sold for a song. Because that's what the whole point is, Tony. That's what I'm going around the houses here, is the councils are being forced to asset strip, and the friends of the Tory central government then turn up like vultures to pick up the pieces.
Jude, what about this call for councils to be given a final say on the arena decision this week?
Well, it's very unusual for this to happen. It's been a cross-party letter to kind of invoke this procedure to have an extraordinary full council meeting. And I think partly it's born out of frustration. It's born out of frustration that Marvin just doesn't communicate well with the rest of the council. One assumes he's meeting with his political cabinet, and one hopes that they know what's going on. But we want to have proper explanations for what's been going on behind the scenes. You know, if there are deals with developers, what's the thought behind it? It's a very valuable piece of land, as mentioned, and this meeting is born out of frustration. He's refused to come to scrutiny meetings. He's refused to come to OSM. So it's this kind of, for a man
who's... OSM?
Oversight, overview and scrutiny. It's the kind of major top scrutiny board of the council.
OSM,
yeah. But it's the thing that's meant to kind of say, let's look at what we're doing, let's just check that we're doing for the best in the city, and it's cross-party, it's chaired by a Tory, so it's meant to be the check and balance. And I think one of the things that's going on in terms of the democratic process in the council is some of us are very, very worried about the checks and balances. You need to know whether the mayor is making what could be another very foolish decision, which is to dispose of a very potentially very valuable piece of land that could make money for the council, and we'll look back a bit like the port decision and go, what was that about?
Yeah, well, it certainly seems to be in the interests of the developers, not the voters. In the background to all of this, I suppose, is that we've got more and more difficult conditions for people who are in work, more and more difficult conditions for people trying to find work. I noticed this week, Martin, in the Daily Mail, the average UK worker is earning £680 a year, less than a decade ago. Now, that's just the average. And of course, the prices of everything go up, but wages are actually average wages are falling.
Well, real wages are dropping all over the industrialised world. It's particularly bad in Britain, and it's particularly bad in the United States. In the United States, real wages haven't risen since 1973. And of course, that's caused a bubble in asset prices, because there used to be a problem that when the economy picked up, people's wages picked up and you got inflation. That no longer happens because of the change of balance of power in the labour market. Well, that means that the asset owning classes have bid up their assets, because of course there's no danger of inflation, and therefore all of there is inflation. It's inflation in asset values. That when they say there's no inflation in Britain, there is. There's inflation in house prices. There's inflation in land prices in the centre of Bristol that we've just been talking about. That is inflation, but it's not counted as inflation. Of course, it's no use to any ordinary people, because their wages don't keep up with it.
No, it's not happening in the shops so much as happening there. This is the Resolution Foundation, Jude. They're saying that the average British worker is earning nearly £680 a year less than a decade ago. Now, they're putting this down to what is actually the macroeconomic effects of the 2008 bailouts. They're saying that those in work are earning on average £13 a week less than before the recession.
Well, I think most people listening to this show would probably agree. They can feel it, you know, we can all feel it in our pockets, can't we? And I see it in Ashley, certainly, the number of vans that people are being, you know, ending up living on the street effectively in a van, or the amount of homeless people we've got. And personally, you know, the number of people that we know are those, you know, real just about managing families who are really, really struggling to make the rent. And of course, this affordable housing, shall we build housing in the middle of the city thing, is an interesting one, because there's no guarantee that we can make housing affordable. We don't have the powers. And there's a real risk that if you have... I was looking today, actually, at the Redcliffe development, the Temple Meads development. There's a big new development in Bedminster. There's a huge amount of this housing or apartments or whatever coming through. But there's a real worry that it'll drive up house prices. And
it's supposed
ordinary
to be affordable.
Bristolians won't be able to live in the city.
This
centre.
Word affordable depends if you're rolling in it, doesn't it, really?
Well, there's some houses just being built down... In Ashley on Newfoundland Road, and I looked at the price of them today, actually, just out of interest, you know, near where the old boxing club is, £450,000 a pop. I mean, that's not St. Paul's.
No, of course not. Asking prices this week have slumped £7,000 in a month. This is the website Rightmove. Now, this is starting to look a little bit dangerous, isn't it, Martin? £7,000 a month, led by London, but the whole of the rest of the country, including Bristol, house prices have started to fall. We even see, I think it's in the Bristol Post this week, and that is Bristol's booming housing market looks like slowing down, says Jack Pitts, and he was the local Democracy reporter. So it is house prices just hit the roof here, and it's starting to go down through the floor now.
Well, I mean, some people might say, well, thank goodness for that, we're now seeing house prices drift downwards. But of course, the real problem with that is that house prices don't just drift downwards a little bit and then become affordable. What you get is ultimately a crash, and I'm 58, and I've lived through several of these housing crashes already, and of course, that means that the economy goes into recession, and it's a leading indicator of recession. And I think coming soon, very soon, to a country near you is a housing crash and a recession. That's what's going to happen
here,
and in Britain and elsewhere.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jude?
Well, I agree. I mean, I don't think you need to be, I agree. It is going to happen. It's going to happen. Bristol has had this big explosion. We've seen loads of people moving in, and house prices have gone up. It is going to happen. We are going to crash. And then, you know, one of the things that's interesting, isn't it, that a lot of this building in the city, even in where I am, Ashley, the Brooks development, the Westmoreland House, it's 10 years to the day for both those developments that they kind of were about to be built, and money's flooded back into the city, and we're kind of on the edge of it happening again, but it could all be over very, very soon, and we end up with this kind of stagnation again where nothing gets built. There's an illusion, I think, that everything's okay.
Well, one place it's definitely not okay is up in Birmingham Prison, which was run by our favourite company, Martin, and I's favourite company, G4S, who we had a little hand in tipping out of running the 2012 London Olympics from this very, well, not actually not this studio, the other studio, by really dishing the dirt on the lies that G4S had been telling to the people organising the Olympics about their plans for security at the London Olympics. But anyway, G4S have been booted out from Birmingham Prison after all sorts of awful conditions. And there was a fascinating on Monday itself on BBC Five Live, at the mum of one of the inmates phoned in. And so let's have a little listen to an excerpt from that now, because it gives you just a bit of an insight into what really goes on inside Birmingham Jail under these private contractors, G4S.
What's it like in there?
Dirty. The officers talk to you like you're something on the end of the shoe. I visit my son twice a week. I went and saw him on Saturday to find out he's been scalded. His right shoulder's absolutely burnt. He's got no skin on it. Somebody's obviously tried to have a go at him on top of his head. He's got blood on top of his head. He's been put on a wing for his own safety, and the other prisoners are still trying to get at him. He's been without electric for 2 days. My son's got mental health problems, and he shouldn't have to live like that. The prison have a care of duty to every prisoner, and especially ones with mental health. My son got remanded in October last year, and for the first few weeks he kept ringing me saying he couldn't cope. And then after that, obviously, like, you know, the visitors was obviously allowed to visit them. G4S talk to you like you're somewhat on the end of the shoe. They've got no control over the prisoners whatsoever. You ask them questions, they talk to you as though you are a prisoner yourself, and we're not. One G4S officer tried to corner my son Matthew, and how can I put it? She swore in front of my 8-year-old son at the time, who was also on a visit with myself.
Have you complained at all?
Yes, I have. I've sent several emails, and all they emailed me back was to do with the toilets, because the toilets was absolutely filthy.
Why do you think it's got to this state?
Personally, I think it's run by young kids. G4S are recruiting young children who are coming out of school and who are coming out of college. If something was to kick off big there, they wouldn't be able to cope with it. Physically, my son can possibly cope with it, but mentally he can't. He has mental health issues. It's already driving him mad. He's been in a cell now for 24 hours. He's locked behind a door. The officers are supposed to go to him to allow him to put on, obviously, money on the machine so he can either buy his canteen, make phone calls to myself to let me know he's okay. They're not doing that. They're supposed to take him across to his nurse to fetch his medication. They're not doing that. So, and then also, he's been without power for 2 days in his cell, because obviously they're allowing the other prisoners to break the power outside his cell door, so he's got no electric for 2 days. He shouldn't live like that.
So you feel like the prisoners are in control of things?
Yes. Yes, yeah. It's not run by G4S, it's run by the prisoners. And also trained staff to deal with the mental health. I got told on Saturday when I went to visit my son, I asked an officer, I says, have you got any trained staff here to deal with the mental health? And her words to me was, no. And I was like, well, my son's brain doesn't work the same as everybody else's.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit worried my son's either going to be come out in a body bag, or he's going to do something to himself because he can't stand it in there any longer.
G4S have been talking to us. I'm going to read the statement out at this point. They haven't been talking to us directly, otherwise we'd have them on, but they've sent out a statement. They've said this. Jerry Petherick is their managing director, and they say, HMP Birmingham is an inner city remand prison which faces exceptional challenges, including increasingly high levels of prisoner violence towards staff and fellow prisoners. The well-being and safety of prisoners and prison staff is our key priority, and we welcome the six-month step-in and the opportunity to work with the Ministry of Justice to urgently address the issues faced at the prison.
So that's a report from Monday from BBC Five Live. Martin, that woman's name was Angela. Her son Matthew in Birmingham prison. It's now been taken over from the government. Why are G4S still being given contracts?
Well, you may well ask, Tony. The fact is that they're a very big company. They're a global company. They operate in the West Bank in Palestine. And they were basically, you know, lots of people are worried about that, and they've messed up virtually everything they've done.
Do they have some sort of special Martin? Do they have some sort of special pleading to get these in, or what?
Well, they are part of the, you know, the prison security military complex. You know, they supply people to fight in Afghanistan and stuff like this. You know, I mean, basically they are parasites. I mean, in Norway, for example, where they've got a well-run prison system with modern prisons which are built to order and the lowest recidivism rate in Europe, the idea that private companies like G4S should be allowed to run the prisons would just be laughed at. What on earth are you thinking of? Because, of course, G4S's bottom line isn't what they said, the safety of prisoners. G4S's bottom line is profit for G4S. And, of course, there's something morally repugnant about locking people up for profit. And, of course, in well-run socialist Scandinavian countries, they don't allow it. Quite right, too.
Sorry about that. Carry on, Jude. What was your reaction to that?
Well, it's really, really sad, isn't it? And yes, we shouldn't be locking people up for profit. We have a prison system that we know has not worked well for years and years and years. We used to have prison officers who were public servants. It's been privatised. It's all for profit. And it's not necessarily in the interest of G4S to even provide a decent service. They seem to get away with it every time. They must have, you know, how you can fail and fail and fail and fail and still get offered contracts is to most people beyond understanding. You couldn't do that in, you know, in your normal job. You'd be sacked. So it's all about the money. And it's very, very sad for parents and their children who are suffering. I mean, as I understand it, one of the big issues is also something that we've got a problem with in Bristol. So, you know, spice, synthetic drugs that are being brought into the prisons, which is maybe it's a new thing that you've not had to deal with in prisons. But like Martin said, in Scandinavia, they don't seem to have these problems.
Well, I've got a friend, actually, named Sabine McNeil. She's in jail in London. She needs vitamin supplements, things like that. They won't let her have the vitamin supplements. She's written letters to me last week from jail, said I can't get my vitamin supplements. That means that I find it very difficult to actually even get up. She's got problems with her joints, and yet apparently you can get the drugs in these jails. Isn't this also, go on, sorry,
and what you can't get in jails? You asked me what I did before I was a counsellor. So one of the things I've done for the last decade is work for the Open University, and the Open University has a very substantial programme of education within prisons. But when you go into a prison to support somebody who's trying to better themselves and get an education, you notice how poor the educational provision is. And we know it's really, really well received and documented that most people in prison are there, have had disrupted educations, and one of the ways to ensure that people can manage themselves and their families better when they get out is to give them some kind of training and education. And I can bet, you can bet your bottom dollar that G4S are not doing it. In fact, you've just reminded me that that's one of the problems, isn't it? The education contract was taken away from providers like the Open University and offered again to some educational provider who we probably don't know what they're doing. So it's a kind of more than one thing wrong with what we're doing to try and rehabilitate people.
Just one
people.
Other thing about G4S before you come in, Martin. They also run all the security for GCHQ as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, you could, and having all this privatisation of things like that opens you up to being infiltrated. I mean, there was a reason why all that stuff was run in house. You know, things like security for your top security bases. And, you know, this privatisation of the state is just a boondoggle, because of course if you've got a government contract to do something like that, there's no real competition. Even if you mess up, you're not going to lose the contract. So it's money for old rope, and there's no market justification for that. But what it does is it creates a G4S, no doubt. I've got plenty of deep pockets to fund political candidates that they'd like to see elected.
What's the macroeconomics of all of this, though? Because, you know, surely the government should be able to afford and run its prisons and do exactly what Jude was saying, make sure that there's educational programs in there to actually, I mean, the whole idea of going to prison is not just punishment, is it? The idea is to give people a reason to carry on and do the right thing when they leave.
Well, what's interesting, of course, is once you've privatised something like, you know, the education service in prisons, that then becomes the measured part of the private sector. And of course, it's a delusion. The money's actually still public money, but it's now counted as if it's the private sector. And of course, that's what the Tories want. They want to get the private sector to be the dominant sector, and the public sector to just be a residual last little bit, you know, just a contractor, really. But of course, and on that basis, they're willing to spend money on prisons because they're going to get some of it. And of course, in the US, it's gone right the way down, where you've got a situation where people who are involved in the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s, where they were bringing drugs into America, then use the profits to create private prisons so that they can profit off the people who've got busted for using the drugs that they brought in. And there was a guy in the US, it was sent down for sending juveniles to a detention facility.
That's right, he was a judge,
and he was sending juveniles for a detention facility in which he had a personal profit, a personal stake. And of course, he got arrested. He got done for that.
I wonder
kind of conflict of interest is almost inevitable. Once you've done this,
judges, Jude, have got shares in G4S.
It would be really interesting to find out, wouldn't it? If anyone knows, they could ring in.
Anyway, your experience in prisons, did you see examples of better and worse run prisons? Any idea about what the ethos was that made a prison good or bad? Because Birmingham's obviously in an absolutely diabolical state.
Not really, because actually, you know, we don't have the... When I had to visit two prisoners, both in open prison, so I don't think I had an experience of what that's like. Really, it was just that their reflections on wanting to being the sort of prisoners who wanted to better themselves and get an education, and how hard it was, including just being moved around a lot. So, you know, if you're doing the OU, you're not allowed to use the computers, so you have to have everything done by paper, everything, you know, sent in still. And it was just very, very hard for them to get anything done. And it's just very wasteful, isn't it? It's very wasteful of people's lives, and it's very wasteful of resources in general.
Okay, looking at the wider side of this, let's just talk about Brexit for a minute, because we've had this advice come out this week from the government at last about two businesses, about how they're supposed to prepare for Brexit, even though it's a little bit thin. Jude, what do you make of it? Bristol as a whole voted against Brexit, voted to remain, but the country, we're going to have to go with the rest of the country unless we want to declare ourselves an independent city-state, aren't we?
We are. It's also worrying that, I mean, there's been a bit of a tide turn, hasn't there? There was something in the Post last week saying that three of our Yates, Thornbury and somewhere else had changed their mind on that. So, you know, Bristol is very pro remaining at the moment. But the worry is we'll be dragged over the cliff. But also, from the point of view of being in local government, there is nothing happening in Bristol to do with what we're going to do about Brexit, because we're so distracted by lots of other things. We've got our own kind of special Brexit with the arena, where everybody's attention is just on that. And it really worries me.
I like that. It's your own special Brexit. It's almost like you think something you've got to get to grips with, and it's a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah. But, you know, we don't know. I don't think we know how many... how many European citizens we've got who may be leaving or have left. You know, we could find that the schools have lots of spare places, and you know, I don't think anybody's done any research. I can't find out whether anyone's done any research within the City Council about what's going to happen. And it feels to me like we're just pretending it's not going to happen.
Well, the goalposts seem to be shifting as well. Just heard a couple of hours ago, October is no longer the deadline for the Brexit deal. David Lidington has indicated the Cabinet Office Minister says finalising the agreement the following month would be manageable. So apparently it's November now, Martin.
Well, I think the idea that just kicking the can down the road and still thinking about it is Theresa May's decision to start the clock running. There's nobody on the European side expected that, and they're perfectly prepared to carry on talking about it. We'll just carry on as we are until we've sorted it out, and that's a rational thing to do.
So what will happen on the 29th?
Don't just put your hand in the fire. Have a think about it first, and we'll discuss it, you know.
29th of March next year is the actual date. What will happen then?
Well, we don't know. I mean, one of the things about these little briefings, they're only two-page summaries of things that people might do with a no-deal Brexit. And what they said to the people in Northern Ireland is, why don't you ask Dublin? Which is hilarious, I thought. Ask Dublin what you're going to be doing.
Anyway, for the Greeks, they are in a different situation to Britain, of course, because they haven't got their own currency anymore. We've got the pound. But the Greeks are getting very, very frustrated with the Brussels people. And I suppose they're a bit envious about for us actually having the vote, having actually a referendum here, because they haven't had one.
They had a referendum and
it
was ignored.
That's right. They had one over the bailout terms, didn't they? Well, anyway, they've got a new bailout this week, which apparently is going to sort everything out for the final time. Well, if you believe that, you believe anything. But there was a terrific little intervention on the World Service on World Update with Dan Damon. And who was he interviewing? Yanis Varoufakis. He had put a very different spin on what this final so-called bailout means for the Greeks, really.
What we are now experiencing is the end of the third bailout and the beginning of the fourth one, which is going to last, they hope, until 2032. Look, let's define our terms. What is a bailout? It's a combination of two things. On the one hand, a facility provided by the creditors so that the country can pretend merrily to be repaying its debt to them when it really is not. And secondly, stupendous self-defeating austerity. None of this is going to change. The only difference now is that with the third, second and first bailouts, instead of being given fresh money, Greece, up until 2032, is going to be given easy repayments that, of course, will be rolled over with interest after 2032. That is the only difference.
What would have happened those years ago had your policy, which was an orderly bankruptcy within the euro, where would we be where we're not now?
Oh, Europe would have been much better off. Look, what happened in 2010 was a crime against logic. The good people of Germany, the good people of Slovenia, a very poor country of Portugal, were forced, the taxpayers, to bail out the German and the French banks that had inanely lent gigantic quantities of money to the states of Greece, Italy, Ireland, and so on and so forth. So there was a cynical transfer of private bank losses onto the shoulders of European taxpayers. The result of that, because those transfers, those bailouts, came attached with strings of harsh austerity that put the European Union into a deflationary mode that in the end begot the nationalist international that is now tearing apart the heart and soul of the European Union. You see the policies of Matteo Salvini in Italy, the ultra-right-wing government in Austria. You can see the travails of Angela Merkel in Germany. They effectively injured the European Union by means of the phony bailouts of countries like Greece.
What is it like for people in Greece now? They're given this supposedly good news. You say it's not all that good, but can things improve? Will the young people? I think unemployment has fallen a little, hasn't it? Will the young people get jobs? Will they stay home?
Do you know why unemployment has fallen?
I don't.
Because people have left. It is a travesty. This is the insult that is being heaped upon the injury. Unemployment has fallen because, as I said before, we are losing about 15,000 young men and women who are brilliantly well educated, many of them with master's degrees from places like the United Kingdom, Germany, and so on. And this is no cause to celebrate. Let me put it this way. Why did I resign in July of 2015? Because I was not going to take another huge loan on condition that I would push up corporate taxes by 3 or 4% and impose upon even small businesses the duty to pay this year 100% of estimated taxes of next year. This is what you do when you are crashing a country. It's not just me. Believe me, nobody in Greece takes this triumphant note of the European institution seriously that the bailout has ended. Nothing has ended. The Great Depression is continuing.
Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek finance minister.
Well, all I can say is that's a masterly summary of what's wrong with what's been going on. And, of course, he was very smart, Varoufakis, to leave the Syriza government when he realised that they weren't going to do the sensible things that he was recommending. And he's still out there telling it like it is.
His experience does sound a little bit similar to the British experience when it comes to negotiating with Brussels.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not quite as horrific, is it? And we're not seeing it in the same way because we're pretending that things are going to be fine, but it is not dissimilar.
It doesn't sound like we're going to get a deal due, does it? Really?
Well,
I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, Yanis describes it as trying to negotiate with someone that isn't going to negotiate. I mean, we had a clip last week, didn't we, where he's talking about, well, they're saying you've got to give us all of the things you want before we will start negotiating with you.
It's terrifying. I think it's absolutely terrifying. And we seem to exist in this state of, you know, merrily floating down this river, going over the edge. And most people don't want to talk about it. Most people I speak to on the street or knocking on doors don't really want to talk about it. There's a big sense of denial generally, isn't there? And I think if you're aware of things and you are in any kind of political or economic system or you're running a company, it is absolutely terrifying.
I mean, it's not as if everything is going to stop come Brexit Day, but things are definitely going to change. Martin, I noticed the Labour Party, several people in the Labour Party have come out this week talking about the possibility of a shift to the far right if there is a second vote and it goes to Remain, because this would play into the hands of the far right here. And it's certainly something that we've seen in other parts of Europe, isn't it? Where there has been no choice given, the far right seems to jump on this as a sort of, I think he called it there, a nationalist international, didn't he, Yanis?
Yeah, well, I mean, if there was a second referendum, I'm not saying there should or shouldn't be, and Remain won, then the same arguments would hold, because we're now leaving because Leave won the referendum, even though they didn't win in Northern Ireland or Scotland, or it looks like the opinion polls show now in Wales, because there is a shift moving towards Remain. I mean, the obvious solution, as Farrah Farkas hinted in the stuff he did last week, is a soft Brexit. We just take a Norway option off the peg. So we leave the European Union in name, but in practice we stay in it. And of course the negotiations with Greece and with us are quite different in a sense, because we're negotiating about the fundamentals of the European Union. They're negotiating about whether they should be, you know, taxed to bail out Deutsche Bank. It's not quite the same thing. And of course it's not really...
Martin, Labour's Barry Gardner has said, yes, that it could cause... It could cause civil disobedience.
I saw what he said, but I mean...
I think, is this scare tactics?
I think it's silly, because in actual fact, if the Queen in Parliament decides to have another referendum, the British Constitution says we can. And I'm not saying whether we should.
Does the Queen decide these
No,
things?
I'm just saying that's the constitution of the country, Tony. And people say you've got to... The British Constitution says that if Parliament decided not to go for Brexit, they wouldn't even have to have a referendum if they chose to do that, because Parliament is sovereign. Ask the Democratic Unionist Party. They'll tell you all about the British Constitution. And, of course, it's only a political reason that we can't have a second referendum. And at some point, there may be a second referendum if there's a massive change in public opinion.
The Labour Party officially is saying that there may be, although they... don't really seem
well,
to
they're keeping
one.
Their options open.
Anyway, Jude, what do you make of this accusation that it could cause the rise of the far right if there is another referendum? That's what Labour's Barry Gardner is saying.
I think it could. I think we are on uncharted territory, and I think although all these discussions are very much in the abstract, aren't they, about, you know, whether we should have a referendum, this and the other, but what will happen in terms of money, there will be big parts of Britain that suffer terribly, parts of Wales, Cornwall, the reality of things not being built, money not being spent on services will start to hit, and there will be a huge amount of pain, and that will show in people reacting, and how that will play out, it will be very worrying. I mean, we remember, I'm old enough to remember poll tax rights and stuff like that, and I think I'm constantly surprised at how people aren't very angry about what's happening, about whether you think the decision was right or wrong. We are not being managed well by our leaders, are we?
You know what I think is, people aren't quite so well organised as they were in the 1980s.
I agree,
Martin.
No, they're not. And of course, the whole purpose of the neoliberal reform, if you like, was to smash the trade unions after the defeat of the miners' strike in the 1980s. It wasn't just about the miners; it was to break the power of the trade union movement in this country.
It's not that people aren't angry, aren't annoyed.
No, but they're not focused.
I mean, let's take this call for a people's vote. In some ways, it is a kind of call to organise, isn't it? It's saying, you know, come together and organise and speak and collectively show that we want something that's not yet on the table. And it is, perhaps it's too little too late. I hope it's not. But even the organising and the, you know, whether Labour, Greens, Liberals can act together, all sorts of other people who aren't in political parties, people don't know what to do. That's the other thing. We are not being led.
People don't have the time and money to do this organising that they did in the 70s and 80s. Anyway, one of the real thing everyone pretty much agrees on is that the mainstream media have been pretty hopeless in actually untangling Brexit. I mean, I did my best on YouTube with a thing called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit back in, 2 years ago. And that went down reasonably well. I mean, it's got quite a lot of views. But I think there just hasn't been a real attempt to penetrate what the European Union is and what it means to leave it, and you know, the various penalties and the various benefits that there might be. So having a go at the media is what we like to do on here, because we're not really mainstream media, we're on the fringes there. And it was great to hear Jeremy Corbyn yesterday doing the Labour leader doing the MacTaggart lecture up at the Edinburgh Television Festival, which people may remember, one of our local playwrights from the Forest of Dean, Dennis Potter, did very famously in the 1990s, in 1993, I think it was. Have a look at that if you want to see a fascinating lecture with all the these television bosses leaving the room, and you can almost see the hair standing up on the back of their neck with what Dennis had to say. It wasn't quite such a performance by Jeremy Corbyn yesterday, but he had quite a lot of interesting stuff to say. And I was also very disappointed to see yesterday that even though he was talking quite a lot about the future of the BBC, the BBC on their main bulletin at 6 o'clock didn't even report it. So anyway, let's have a listen to what Jeremy Corbyn had to say, at least part of it now.
As well as being paid a decent wage, media workers should be, as far as possible, freed from political and special interest pressures from above. We know that the BBC could be and is, I believe, tacitly influenced by government through the charter renewal process and the setting of the licence fee. If we want an independent BBC, we should consider setting it free by placing it on a permanent statutory footing with a new independent body setting the licence fee. The licence fee itself is another potential area for modernisation. In the digital age, we should consider whether a digital licence fee could be a fairer and more effective way of funding the BBC. A digital licence fee supplementing the existing licence fee collected from tech giants and internet service provider, which extract huge wealth from our shared digital space, could allow a democratised and more plural BBC to compete far more effectively with the private multinational giants like Netflix, Amazon, Google and Facebook. This could also help reduce the cost of the licence fee to poorer households. With secure funding and empowered staff and audience, the BBC would be on a firm footing to move forward into the 21st century, educating, informing and entertaining, which is what it was set up to do, and be a vehicle to drive up standards for the rest of the media. But we should also think about ways to empower journalists, audiences and readers, and reduce the power of media bosses and owners in the private sector. One of the more radical and interesting ideas I've heard, which limits the power of unaccountable media barons without state control, is to give journalists the power to elect editors and have seats on boards for workers and consumers. When a title or programme gets particularly large and influential, journalists at The Guardian now elect their editor by an indicative ballot, and there's no reason why that precedent shouldn't be spread more widely. If, for example, an outlet gets a certain audience share, then its journalists could be given the right to elect their editors, making them accountable to their staff and their journalists' ethics, as well as to corporate bosses and shareholders. You could take this further at a higher audience share, with enforced shareholder dilution with equity and seats on the board awarded to workers and readers, viewers or listeners. To improve our media, open it up and make it more plural, we need to find ways to empower those who create it and those who consume it over those who want to control it and own it. The final idea I'd like to share with you today, which I hope will generate some new thinking, is about how we, as a public, and the media as an industry take advantage of new technology. I want us to be as ambitious as possible. The public realm doesn't have to sit back and watch as a few megatech corporations hoovered up digital rights, assets, and ultimately our money. This technology doesn't have an inbuilt bias towards the few. Government is standing by and letting the few take advantage of the many using the technology. So, one of the more ambitious ideas I've heard is to set up a publicly owned British Digital Corporation as a sister organisation to the BBC. The idea was floated by James Harding, former BBC Director of Home News, in the Hugh Cudlip lecture earlier this year. A BDC could use all of our best minds, the latest technology, and our existing public assets, not only to deliver information and entertainment to rival Netflix and Amazon, but also to harness data for the public good. A BDC could develop new technology for online decision-making and audience-led commissioning of programmes, and even a public social media platform with real privacy and public control over the data that is making Facebook and others so very rich at the present time. The BDC could work with other institutions that the next Labour government will set up, like our National Investment Bank, and alongside it the National Transformation Fund, strategic investment boards and regional development banks, and our public utilities, to create new ways for public engagement, oversight and control of the very key levers of our economy. It could become the access point for public knowledge, information and content currently held in the BBC archives, for example, the British Library and the British Museum. Imagine an expanded iPlayer giving universal access to license fee payers for products that could rival Netflix and Amazon. It could probably sell pretty well overseas as well. We need big, bold, radical thinking on the future of our media. Without it, at best, we won't take advantage of the opportunities in front of us as a country, and for the kind of journalism that makes the world a better place. At worst, a few tech giants and unaccountable billionaires will control huge swathes of our public space and therefore our public discourse. I hope that some of the ideas I put forward today generate further ideas and the debate widens as Tom Watson and others in the Labour Party develop our policies in this area. We can build a free, vibrant, democratic and financially sustainable media in the digital age. We just need to harness the technology, empower the best instincts of media workers, wherever possible put the public in control and take on the power of the unaccountable billionaires who claim they're setting us free, but in reality are holding us back from achieving what we can all achieve together. Thank you very much.
That's the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, in Edinburgh, yesterday giving the McTaggart lecture about the future of the press, talking a lot about the BBC, but the BBC didn't report it, Jude. They may have reported it on the telly. I certainly didn't report it on the radio. What do you make of one of the things particularly he's talking about there is the idea of getting people like Netflix, Amazon, Google and Facebook to contribute to public service broadcasting at the BBC.
I actually think that that's a good idea. I mean, one of the things that we know is happening in the world is those big organisations are using data, big data, monetising it massively. And for various reasons, governments and nation states have not kept up with that. So there does need to be some way of sorting that out. It's been put forward by quite a lot of people. I mean, it's not a new idea that there should be some kind of tax or way of siphoning off that money to use for all sorts of things, for public good in general. It's something that Molly Scott-Cato, the MEP, was talking about several years ago. So it's an interesting one. And if we had a government that was functioning and able to look at stuff and develop stuff and put money into thinking about things, perhaps we'd be moving a bit further forward.
Not just cut stuff. Martin, what do you make of what Jeremy Corbyn's saying?
Well, it's well thought out, and of course he's making a bid there to, you know, if I become Prime Minister, this is the sort of thing we're going to do. And it's about time this kind of big sky, blue sky thinking was. You know, why do we have to put up with the Barclay Brothers and Murdoch?
If you owned a newspaper, would you be happy about the journalists that you employed electing your editor?
Well, you probably wouldn't, but it's not supposed to make Rupert Murdoch smile, is it? It's supposed to make him wince.
Okay.
It depends whether you own a newspaper. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? In Bristol, we've got the cable. We've got a cooperative, member-owned newspaper stroke that has an online platform, and that's seen as kind of quite unusual and, you know, radical, whereas in some ways it's not, is it? I mean, he cites The Guardian as an example of the way things can be done. Now, The Guardian is, of course, a very interesting paper in its own right. Its whole history and political history is different in some ways, and it's one of the only papers that's remained kind of semi-independent. So, you know, when you lose control of anything... you lose control of it. We've lost control of the media in this country, and that's one idea. He's suggesting one idea to get it back. But we need investment in that.
Okay, well, we had last year, we had Charlottesville, and it was a whole bunch of statues of people who were being, attempts anyway, to knock them down. This year, it's in Arkansas, this over the last week, we've had quite a struggle between the Christians who put up a Ten Commandments monument in Little Rock, Arkansas, outside their Capitol building, which was then driven into and smashed down by a driver, and then at the end of last week, the Satanic Temple brought their Baphomet into town and have are now campaigning to have that installed outside.
Good people of Arkansas and supporters of religious liberty, I present to you Baphomet, a symbol of pluralism, legal equality, tolerance, free inquiry, freedom of conscience, and reconciliation. We did not bring Baphomet here in hopes of replacing the Ten Commandments monument. It is not the purpose of our monument or our efforts to erect this monument to impugn or silence the beliefs of others. Despite what you have probably heard, the truth is the Satanic Temple never asked for the Ten Commandments monument to be taken down, nor do we ask that Baphomet be erected to the exclusion of any other monuments of religious significance. In fact, from the beginning we were clear. We only want our monument on public grounds where other monuments of religious significance are pre-existing. We have as little interest in forcing our beliefs and symbols upon you as we do in having the beliefs of others forced upon us. What we are asking for is only that the public square, these Capitol grounds, remain an area in which free speech, religious liberty, and equality under the law be respected by the holders of public office who swore to uphold those values. This is not a protest against the Ten Commandments. This is not a protest of Satanists against Christians. This is not a protest of secularists against believers. This is a rally for reason in the face of prejudice, progress in the face of decline, liberty in the face of rising theocracy, and toleration in the face of infantile tribalisms.
This might sound a sort of silly story, but actually it's quite serious in a way, Jude, isn't it? It's about religious freedom and whether people... I mean, it's the First Amendment in the US. They take this sort of thing quite seriously. And the politicians, they're saying to the politicians, come on, you're going to have to make a decision here. Are you going to have the Ten Commandments? If you're going to have the Ten Commandments, you're going to have Baphomet too.
I'm just glad I don't live in America, actually. So, you know...
Martin?
Well, in the US, of course, there is officially a separation between church and state, so it's very different from here, where we've got an official Church of England. So in actual fact, it's not actually... when they put up the Ten Commandments outside a public building, that's actually against the Constitution.
And so someone has knocked it down. So, I mean, surely that... Is it?
Yes, it is. I mean, you're not allowed to push forward any particular religious view on public property in the US. It was part of the 1776
Constitution.
Well, what you've got is you've got some people in the US who are so convinced of their rightness as Christians that they feel that there is a right for Christians to have their stuff in the Constitution. But it was written with that specifically in mind, because they had a mixed population with very different views about religion. So they were the first country in the world to say, right, well, we're not going to have any... The government itself is not going to have any religion, which is a rational policy.
And they were mostly Freemasons that set it up, weren't they?
Well, they were mostly Freemasons, yes. And many of them were Christians, and in fact it's a very religious country, but because they were split, they decided that any particular religion cannot be pushed by the state, which is, in the circumstances, quite a sensible view, isn't it?
Okay, well, that's time for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks to our guest, Green Councillor for Ashley, that's Jude English. Join us after the news as we look at the global picture.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.